My father was an actual pimp. My mom, she was one of his many, many prostitutes. He introduced my mother to crack cocaine. He molested me. They took us away. I got charged with second-degree murder.
In this episode, I invite and interview Dale Turcotte, a man who endured unspeakable horrors as a child and found himself trapped in a cycle of anger, violence, and addiction. Dale opens up about his traumatic experiences with drug addiction and neglectful parents that eventually led him to the foster care system, where he faced more abuse in the hands of sexual predators. Consumed by all the pent-up anger, Dale took the law into his own hands that resulted in a tragic act that landed him in prison. He also talks about his own battles with addiction in his latter years, which was his final rock bottom where he contemplated ending his own life. Against all odds, Dale's story takes a remarkable turn as he discovers a newfound strength within himself. Through resilience and unwavering determination, he embarks on a journey of healing and self-transformation. Dale's story serves as a powerful reminder that no matter how bleak things may seem, there's always hope for redemption and a chance to rewrite one's own narrative. Dale, welcome to Multispective. I am so excited to have you here on the show.
Yes, I'm glad. Thank you very much.
Guys, this is an episode to listen to. Dale has woken up super early for this. And there is a really strong message here that he really wants to get around to listeners today. So stay tuned, listen in. And we've got a lot to unravel today as well for you. Dale, why don't we start off a little bit from way back when you were born? Where were you born? What was your family like? Are you close to your family members?
I tell people this, my story started before I was born. So my mother was the youngest out of 13 children. Oh, sorry, the youngest girl, pardon me, out of 13 children. And I live in Manitoba, Canada. So she lived up north in Manitoba, which is a province, if some of you aren't familiar. And it was just it's a very, very small town, still very boring. The only thing good about that town is my auntie and my cousins. But she wanted to get away and spread her wings because she was kind of a hippie type. This was before late 70s. So she moved to Toronto, Canada. And unfortunately, she met my father. Now, what she didn't know was that my father was an actual pimp. So my mom fell in love with him. From what I hear, a very, very charming man, very handsome. I don't remember it that way. I remember him looking like an ogre, but apparently he was like very charming. And she fell in love with him. And once she actually loved him and he knew it, he turned her out and he put her on the street. And she was one of his many, many prostitutes. And he used to sleep with them. And he got her pregnant. And as the story goes that I heard, because of that, because he's Italian, he had to marry her. Because her grandparents were from the old country. So he married her. In all the wedding pictures, I'm 6 months in her tummy. So I'm actually in the wedding photos. You just can't see me.
Right.
Yeah. And then, I was born. And as well, back when I used to try to be cool, we'd say I was a product of the game. So, things kept up like that. I had an older sister too. So things kept up like that. And my mother told one of the other girls that she wanted to go back home. This was no life for her kids. She wanted to go back home. So that girl ran to my dad and told him. So he introduced my mother to crack cocaine. So my mom was addicted for about a year. And then she beat that addiction and kept doing whatever in Toronto. Life's falling apart. And my family's begging her to come home, like on her side. And she decided she was going to save up money. Because my dad thought she was still doing crack. So he's still giving her money. Trying to get her.
And this point, like, how old were you at this point when he got her?
I wasn't old enough to remember yet. Yeah, I wasn't old enough to remember yet. But so when she tried to leave again, they introduced her. Well, my dad introduced her to heroin, and then things really fell apart. And then this is where I start remembering because I remember the parties. I remember people passed out. I do remember some needles. And then I remember a lady starting to come visit us. And every time she left, my mom would be crying. And later on, I found, well, as I got older, I realized it was a social worker. And eventually when I was five, they took us away. So they apprehended my sister and I. And I remember them telling me, go get your favorite toy. We're going to watch a movie. And then we got in this car and never came home again. So we ended up in emergency placement overnight, emergency placement next day. And then we got tossed to another one. And actually, I got my teeth cleaned yesterday at my dentist, and I told him this story. So when we went to our third foster home in 3 days, I'm pretty sure it was, this guy's like, you're going to be with us for a while. He's like, go pick some hygiene products. And I was like, what's hygiene? So I was only five. So he tells me it's like a toothbrush. It's like soap. That's hygiene. He goes, go get your toothbrush stuff. So I picked a Spider-Man cup, a Spider-Man toothbrush, and bubblegum toothpaste. I remember that. So we're lined up, and they ring everything through, and I'm still standing there with my toothbrush. And the cashier goes, can I see your toothbrush, please? So I gave it to her. She scanned it, gave it back to me. When she handed it back to me, I looked at it, and I started bawling because I realized I was never going home again. And the next year, my mom actually committed suicide. And so I never did go home again. And I don't know what it was. I think a toothbrush means home because it's yours. It's your bathroom, you know. I never traveled, so I didn't know you take toothbrushes with you. But that's what made me kind of think about, like, the human brain is wired so weird. Like, for something like that to traumatize me. And here's the kicker. That was when I was five. I never brushed my teeth until 3 years ago. So I went that long without brushing my teeth because I was that toothbrushed that day. So
it was like it triggered some serious, like, deep-rooted trauma in you.
And I remember, like, trying to brush my teeth and just, like, the whole process was okay. Putting toothbrush on once or toothpaste. Once I got here, it was, like, shaking and, like, almost tearing up. And it was weird. And I was a grown man. So 3 years ago, I finally realized I need to encourage my son to brush his teeth. I need to show him how to brush his teeth. So I finally got over that 3 years ago for my son. So, but yeah, it's weird how the brain's connected.
Yeah, I know. Like the little like vivid memories that trigger so much, like such deep trauma, right?
Yeah.
Can you just talk to me a little bit about your sister in this process? Like, she ended up going to the foster homes, jumping from foster home to foster home with you. So did you develop quite a deep sort of connection and bond with her in that time? Or did you sort of like get drifted apart? Like, what happened with her?
We were like, she was my comfort blanket. Like, we had to be together. I don't know who promised my mom, but after she died, we were told not to be separated. They couldn't separate us. So when we were in the foster home, we went to another foster home after the hygiene place. We were only there for like a week. And then we went to Newmarket, Ontario, Canada. And there was this foster mom. She was cool, but she had like a living room for her real kids and a living room for her foster kids. The one for her real kids had a TV, video game, VCR. Ours had crayons, paper, pens, and maybe a toy or two. There's a lawsuit going on against a priest and then one against his foster mom. So I needed to order all my disclosure from when I was in foster care. So about 4 or 5 months ago, I received 278 pages of documentation of when we were taken away. So I read about the horrific shit that got us taken away. I read about things that happened once we were gone with my mom and my dad. My mom showing up to visits drunk, late. Stuff like that. My dad being in prison for doing stuff to my sister. Like, it was so horrific reading that stuff. And it just sucked. But in that documentation, I talked about how much I loved this foster mother and how comfortable I was there, how safe I was there. Because the big thing that scared me, according to that paperwork, was drinking. I know my parents drank. I know they had disgusting people in our house. Like, disgusting. Like, I'm talking like child predators. They would let party in our home. And there was a couple times that my dad would go talk to somebody and then that person would leave with my sister into her bedroom and then come out and my sister was crying and the guy gave my dad drugs. That's how much of a piece of shit my father was. Yeah. It's just like mind boggling. So, yes.
Do you recall anything like happening to you or anything that made you feel uncomfortable? Like, do you remember?
Well, I know a lot of stuff made me feel uncomfortable. But nothing ever went that far with me. Like I honestly think there's two reasons. Either one, my sister put herself in front of me to protect me because she was 3 years older. Or number two, because I was my father's biological child. He favored me and decided not to do that or put me through whatever. So, but with the foster mom, we talked about like how much we loved her, how comfortable we were, this and that. And then when my uncle and auntie, they were supposed to adopt us, but one of my uncles only wanted my sister, didn't want me. So they said, no, we can't do that. We promised your mom we'd keep you together. So then my other uncle was going to adopt me and my sister. And then in the paperwork, it says, like, after saying how much I love Janice, how much, how comfortable I was, how this and that, how much we got along, all of a sudden it says that when we're at the airport leaving, I didn't even say goodbye to her. I ran away. I ran away and got on the plane. So the reason was because she had, her father used to come over on the weekends. I remember I loved the smell of his pipe tobacco. We were allowed to eat granola cereal when he was around, like just certain things. And then he'd stand at the top of the stairs and he'd sing Teddy Bear's Picnic. I'm not sure if you know that song, but it's a children's song. He'd stand there and he'd sing it till we fell asleep. One night he decided to come in my room and go under my blanket and try to put his hand in my pajamas. So I made a fuss. He left. And then I reported to my foster mom. She got so frigging mad at me, like just lost her mind. So my mom, the day of my mom's funeral, she like was helping me get dressed and she pulled down my zipper, pulled down my underwear, grabbed my penis, pulled it out of the hole and started like pulling it, saying, is this what your fucking dad used to do to you? Like just angry because they suspected something happened to me too with my dad, but it never did, but they suspected it. And then she did that so much that my penis cut on my zipper. Like that's how bad she was doing that. And that was the day of my mother's funeral. So we're at the funeral. Afterwards, I go to my social worker and I tell my social worker what happened. She tells me, you guys are moving soon. Can you hang in there and be brave? I was like, okay. I'm like 6 years old. I'm scared because I just reported two things within recent and did not get the reaction that I hoped for. So I decided, yeah, we are moving. I'm going to tough it out, blah, blah, blah. Can't wait to move. And then it happens two more times. Once in the bathtub, I'm sitting in the bathtub and we used to have to say, mom, can I be excused from the table? Mom, can I be excused from the bathtub? And she reached in the bathtub and like went like this and squeezed like as hard as she could to my penis. And I remember it hurting for like a week to pee. And then when I was getting out of the tub another time, she did it again. Same thing, squeezed and it was just painful as hell. So yeah. Finally, when we got to leave, I ran to that plane. I didn't say goodbye. I didn't want to see her no more. I did not want to even look at her. So,
I mean, it's just like so much, like you just being surrounded by, you know, the people that you're supposed to like trust and feel secure around, you know, the very first ones, your own parents, you know, being involved in drugs and, you know, that being a really unsafe, dangerous environment for you. And then moving to another environment, which is meant to be safer, by a system that's meant to protect you, all of which have just continuously failed you and your sister too. And like feeling like you just have no place to turn and no one to talk to. I can't even begin to imagine like what kind of like trauma must have set in that process and how it must have been so hard for you to trust in anyone going forward.
Yeah, that was a big thing too. And when my fiance, when we read that that paperwork together, she just looked at me with like the saddest eyes and she's like, you've been surviving your whole life, right? And I was like, pretty much. And I never heard it put like that, but it's true. It's been hard. But the thing that sucks really bad is when we moved with my uncle to the Indian reservation, we had to go to Sunday school. So that first Sunday school, I told the native preacher, because there was a white guy and a native guy. And I told the native preacher, I was like, my mom just died. And that's why I moved here. And he's like, you need prayer and healing. So he took me to this little office and that white guy lit a candle and started talking and telling me like, that's so sad. How old are you? Blah, blah, blah. And then boom, he got me. He molested me. And that was like right after, like I wasn't even a week from being there, being in the new community, just coming from a place where two people didn't do shit when I reported what happened to me. So now I'm standing here wondering what the fuck, like, is this what adults do to kids? Like, it's so common. Like, is this what's supposed to happen? And then I had to go to Sunday school the next time and I didn't want to talk to that guy. And he's like, I'm so sorry. He's like, blah, blah, blah. What did you say again? He's like, the devil got into me or something. And he's like, you know, I asked God for forgiveness. And then he asked me for help trimming trees outside. And then he did the ultimate sexual assault. And I was 6 years old. And
what do you mean when you say the ultimate sexual?
He actually raped me. Yeah. Like penetration. And I was 6 years old. And then I remember him saying, if you tell anybody, I'm going to make sure you go back to foster care. And he did it the following week again after talking me into trusting him. I have no fucking idea how. But then I went home and I looked at my uncle and I just told him, I was like, I don't want to go to Sunday school no more. And I think he saw something in my eyes, just like, you don't have to go. And he looked concerned and it looked like he wanted to talk more. But my uncle wasn't really he was a great man, taught me so much. Great, great man. But he just didn't know how to show emotions. So he gave me a look and it felt like he wanted to go further, like ask me what's going on, but he never did. He just said, I don't have to go anymore. My life, so this is how my life was. So after that, I moved with my uncle, Mr. No Emotions. Well, I was still with him. Sorry. I was with him for 5 years. Then I moved to my other uncle's, who's worse than that. Great guy, but just no emotions also. And then I moved to a foster home in Winnipeg, Canada, where I met two of the greatest people in my life, which was my foster dad and his worker, his respite worker. And we used to have to sit in a circle and talk about our past. But so many times I wanted to bring it up, but these other boys were there. So I trusted Scott so much, but these other boys were there. I didn't want to say that in front of them.
What then led to you going to a youth center, like a detention center?
Yeah.
Yeah. What happened that led you there?
What happened was I assaulted one of my foster brothers, and then I didn't realize Scott's home, it was called a level 5 foster home. So it's like for people with they need not special needs, but they need more attention. They need more hands-on. They need somebody to be there with them all the time. That's called a level 5 foster home. He told me I think he said I was a level 2. And he said, you're only here because I love you. He's here because he needs to be. He goes, you don't realize what you did. And I was like, what? He's like, you have to go now. Fuck. And I love this man. Still do. I call him dad. I call him pop. Mom and pop. I still talk to him. They live 15 minutes away from me.
What led you to assault him, to hurt him?
So this guy, he was special needs, but he always tried to get on my nerves. Always tried to bug me. So in the basement, we had stairs without a railing and it's straight cement on the floor. And he's sitting there throwing dog food at me. And then he's like, ah, fuck you, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And I'm ignoring him. I'm playing my Nintendo, Super Nintendo. And then he goes to get up and he's like, ah, fuck you. Good for you. Your mom died. And I was like, ooh. So I paused it, walked up to him. He sat back down on the steps and I gave him a left hook. And that was a left hook that changed my life. He fell off the side of the stairs, hit his head. He was okay, but I honestly thought I killed him the way everyone was reacting. Scott was kind of emotional. So I was like, did I kill him? So yeah. So I had to go to emergency placement. And then Scott moved with my favorite respite worker, Becky. And they moved to the country where we live now. And in my mind, he abandoned me. Because I was only 13. So I was young. I didn't understand all this stuff. I didn't understand the politics of foster care. I just felt like he got mad at me. He threw me away when I absolutely loved this man, cherished him. So I went back to the house they moved out of, the house where I threw that punch, and brought my friends there. And we smashed it up, $30,000 damage. Like, we ripped out sinks, toilets. My friends thought we were having fun. Meanwhile, I'm like just getting my emotions out, passing out. A real estate agent comes the next day to show the house and we're all sleeping in the living room. So they called the cops. So yeah, so that's my first charge. That's how I ended up in youth lockup. But yeah.
And how long were you there for?
Was only in the actual Manitoba Youth Center for I think a week, and then I got bail, but then they put me in a locked group home setting. It was called Seven Oaks. There was a girl's cottage, a boy's cottage. There were just magnets on the door. That's all.
Oh.
We were supposed to be locked in there, but I always popped the doors open and we all ran. Come back 4 days later, get in trouble. So it was. Yeah.
Is this also like a juvenile delinquency, like a kind of like a mini prison?
It was like for the people that just got out of there, that got bail, that had conditions.
Right.
So you would go from the. I guess the kids' prison, you get bail from there and you'd go to Seven Oaks where it's more, there's more observation. There's more like things are locked up. Your rooms are locked up at night, stuff like that. So it wasn't actually a group home. It was more secure.
And you had like therapy sessions and stuff during this, in this place?
They tried, the counselors and stuff. For me, I didn't start talking to a counselor until almost 2 years ago, my whole life. Because everybody's like, oh, your mom killed herself. Let's talk. But I didn't like the thought of somebody that read a book sitting there telling me, well, I read this book, so this means you have to feel like this, you know? I'd rather have somebody that's been through it, someone that lost their mother, somebody that lost somebody close to them to suicide, somebody whose parents were addicts, like somebody that could relate to me. I didn't want some guy in a suit saying, well, you must feel like this because chapter 4 said that.
Right. Yeah.
So I never liked that stuff until, well, I didn't like it, but 2 years ago, I finally went to counseling.
Do you see the benefit of that now, though?
I do. Yeah. No, what I was getting to when I was jumping ahead like that, when I was telling you, like, in prison, you can't talk about what happened to you, this and that. When I got out of prison, I became an addict. So that numbed everything. But about 3-4 months ago, because I was off drugs, I finally had to start dealing with my childhood bullshit. So finally, I had to admit to my fiance first that I was molested by my foster mom out of anger. I was raped by a priest, you know? So that finally came out because I had no reason to hide it no more. I had nothing to hide behind anymore. I was off drugs, was clean, sober, and there was no reason to be tough anymore. And the scary thing was I thought she was going to look at me as less of a man because of it. But she told me that brought us closer because I actually trusted her to talk about that with her. So, but I just wanted to tell you why it finally came out, why it took 42 years to, or 36 years to finally come out. So that's why.
And that's the thing. Once you open that faucet and you let yourself be vulnerable in a way, it's scary. It's daunting because you don't know how how other people that you love and care about might respond. But at the same time, in a way, it's kind of empowering because now you've gotten that story out. It's out there. It's all raw. It's all open. And now you can start the healing process, which was not possible when it was all blocked up, right?
Exactly. And that priest, what happened that when I couldn't sleep till like 2:30 in the morning, my teachers used to beat me up when I was in grade 2 and 4. Because like on the Indian Reserve, the white teachers used to beat us up. I'm like, have you ever heard of residential schools in Canada? Yeah. Okay.
Like boarding school kind of thing?
It's like boarding school, but they used to like actually physically take Native kids away from their family and put them in these schools, cut their hair. If you spoke your language, you got the whip. They'd just been finding unmarked graves of children outside these churches and residential schools in Canada. They found 215 in Kamloops, BC. So that started this whole movement to dig around old residential schools, old churches, and they've been finding like unmarked graves of children. So, and there's stories of survivors that are just, they're horrific, like fucking horrific. Like, like these people, because it was priests and nuns, and they're getting children pregnant and stuff. And then disposing of that. Like, there's been survivors telling their stories on the news, everything. There's been this whole movement in the last few years. It's called Truth and Reconciliation, where everybody's coming forward and telling their story. And now the government's trying to make it right. So I went to Indian day school, which was a residual of residential school. And so my white teachers used to beat me up. All my Native teachers from the community were awesome, but the white ones used to beat me up. One night I couldn't sleep, so I looked up one of the teachers used to beat me up, couldn't find his name, and then I thought about the priest. So I looked up the priest's name, and it said that he was one of the most prolific pedophiles in Canada. He had between 500 and 600 victims, estimated. He got convicted for 60 victims and only did 6 years for it. And he's still alive. He's living in British Columbia. And then I found out there was a class action lawsuit against him. So, but the church gave him an airplane because he had a pilot's license. So he used to fly to remote communities in northern Manitoba and northern Ontario as a Boy Scout leader and as a priest. And little did they know, he was doing his thing up there. And they said that his legacy on Native men is a high rate of suicide, men that don't know how to be in relationships, men that don't know how to properly be fathers. That's his legacy on Aboriginal men.
So you go to the youth center and you've done your time there, you've gone to the Seven Oaks, you've done your time there as well, and you come back out. What happens then?
By then, I'm too big for foster homes, and I'm too manipulative for group homes. So at 15 years old, they're just like, you know what? Fuck it. We're just going to get you your own apartment. So I moved out on my own when I was 15, which is pretty cool because they paid my rent. They paid my bills. I got grocery money.
Who is this that paid for this?
It's called McDonald Youth Services. So it's like an agency, because the thing is, once we were in foster care, my mom died and everything, we became Crown Ward of Manitoba. So that means the province of Manitoba, Canada, was our legal guardians. So they're responsible for us until we were 18. So when they couldn't find a home for me, they cut a check. Here's your rent. Here's your groceries. If you work a normal job, any money you get, we can't touch.
And 15 years old is too old for foster homes? I thought you would be put into the foster system until 8.
It's like I was too big. Like they thought I looked like the staff. First time I went to the youth center, I was 13, and the guy's like, "Are you staff?" I was like, "No, I'm your roommate."
So, wow.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about where your sister is at this point when you went to the youth center?
Oh, my sister was still she was in a group home actually.
So I guess that time when you were given rent money to live on your own, you're 15 years old, you're fresh out of like this Seven Oaks yes. youth center. You're still in that rebellion phase, I guess. You're still pent up anger. You're still feeling rage. And now you have freedom on top of that. Yes. What do you do next?
Well, I had a full beard when I was 13. So I used to go to the bars every night because and then they were trying to get me to go to school. And every school I went to, I just didn't like it. And once again, everybody thought I was an adult already. So like I'm sitting in this class with all these fresh faced 8th graders and 9th graders. Actually, by then, I guess I would have been in, grade 9 or 10 when I moved on. And I'm sitting with all these people who look like little kids, and I'm sitting here with a beard, barely fitting my desk. And it felt so uncomfortable. So, yeah. But the highest grade I finished, because getting in trouble and stuff, was grade 7. But then while I was in prison the first time, I got my high school equivalent.
What landed you in prison the first time?
So the first time... I'll give you the quick version. Girl I grew up with, there was a bunch of us sitting around at my place. And at the time I worked with the Manitoba Youth and Care Network, which was like almost like a children's advocate. So she asked me if I'd ever worked with kids that were molested. And I said, not directly, but like there's stuff I do for kids like that. But I don't counsel them. I don't work one-on-one with them or nothing like that. And I was like, why'd you ask that? And she's like, never mind. I was like, no, for real. Like you don't just ask questions like that and leave it. So she told me that her father convicted 3 times of molesting her and her 3 sisters. So the first time he only got 3 months followed by, and this is why she was asking me, she said, is this normal? He got 3 months in jail followed by 3 months house arrest where he legally had to stay in the same house as his victims. So that's why she was asking me that question. Did you ever hear of this before? And I was like, fuck no. I was like, that was the worst miscarriage of justice I've ever seen for a victim. So obviously it happens again. This time he gets 12 months followed by 3 months house arrest. And then it happens again. And he gets 18 months followed by 3 months house arrest. So each time they threw him back to his victims. Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
Exactly. Yeah. So like, I don't know.
Is this a thing?
I know about house arrest and stuff. And I know about that. Like when you're on, you can get this much time and this much house arrest. But I've never seen somebody sent back to their victims. But that was his address. That was his home. And the mom stayed with him throughout this until the last one happened. So the night he tells me this, one of my friends borrowed money off me. And then my other friend, after he left, they're like, I thought you didn't like crack. And I was like, I don't. They're like, you don't like drugs. And I was like, no, I don't. And then they're like, well, he borrowed $40 to go buy crack. And I was like, what? No way. And they're like, yeah, he's a crackhead. And I was like, what the fuck? So I went to go try to find him where I know he hangs out, and I couldn't find him. I looked for him for 2 hours because I didn't know about drugs back then. So I didn't know if you got money for drugs, you're going right away to go get them. Like you're not hanging out. You're going to get your drugs right away. I didn't know that. So I went to go look for him for 2 hours, couldn't find him. And then this was back in 99. So there's a payphone there and I called a cab. So I'm waiting for the cab. No, I'm on the phone, sorry, with the cab company. And there's a guy coming across the street. And he's like, who are you on the phone with? And I said, Unicity Taxi. And he's like, ask for 2 of them. So I said, okay. So I asked for 2, hung up the phone. So as we're waiting for the taxis, we start talking. And then he goes, you're a funny motherfucker. He's like, what's your name? And I was like, Dale Turcotte. I said, what's your name? And he tells me. And my heart starts beating. I'm like, that's her fucking dad. Because his first name was Kim, which is very rare for a man if you're not Asian. And the last name was a really weird Portuguese name, I think. So I was just like, this is her fucking dad. Like 4 hours after she told me what he did, he approached me. Like I had no physical description. I didn't know if he was black, white, tall, short, fat, curly hair, bald. I knew nothing except his name. So I was like, holy shit. So I said, who are you drinking with? Because he had a case of beer. And he goes, nobody. And I said, well, I'll pay for the half beer. He goes, you pay for the cab. So I said, okay. So my plan was I was just going to beat the shit out of him for what he did to these girls. So we go to his house. And sure enough, we walk in and there's a framed picture of my friend. So I knew for sure it was him. So We're sitting around for a bit. I'm pretending to drink. I didn't crack my beer. I was pretending to take sips. And then I go to the bathroom. I come out and I point to her picture. And I'm like, I said, is that blah, blah, blah? And he's like, yeah. He goes, that's my princess. I was like, oh, yeah. I said, I know what you did to your daughters, man. And he just kind of looked at me. And the thing I forgot to mention was when he took off his jacket, he was like one of the biggest people I've ever seen, like muscle wise. So I thought I was done, but I was so angry that I didn't care. So I thought I was going to get the shit kicked out of me, but like I said, I was so mad. So when I confronted him, he squared up. Well, I squared up, and then it looked like he kind of did, but it was a weird stance. And then as soon as he moved, I threw three punches. I missed every single one of them. And then he reached out and he grabbed my dick. So when he grabbed my dick, I lost it. I backhanded him. The fight was on. And I would like to say I did it 100% because he was a pervert, because what he did to his daughters. But I do have to admit, when he did that to me, I wasn't a 18-year-old, 320-pound man anymore. I became that 6-year-old boy again. Like, it did something in my head as soon as he grabbed me there. Like, it just put me in victim stance or victim mode, where I felt I had to protect this little tiny Dale that got raped. So I ended up beating the living shit out of him. And then when we were in court, the things they said in court, like I said, I'm not going to get into the details because I did on my buddy's podcast. He was pretty surprised. But when they read the autopsy report in court, I couldn't remember doing half of that stuff to him. Like, he was, like, his ribs were broken back front. There's teeth in his stomach. His hands were crushed. Back was broken in 4 places. Skull fractures. Like, and I don't remember doing half that stuff to him. So I just blacked. Yeah. Like, just blacked right out. And like I said, like, I'd love to say it was 100% because he was a pervert, but it had to do with me becoming a victim again by him doing that. So my lawyer was pretty smart, though, because I got charged with second-degree murder, and my lawyer came and asked me, what do you want from me? And I said, I'll do 10 years, I'll do 20 years, I just don't want life. Just make sure I don't get life, because in Canada, when you get life, you're on parole until the day you die. So say, like, me and my fiancé, and I got life, me and my fiancé, she can accuse me of pushing her. I go back to jail for 2 years before they even review it. So, and that's for the rest of your life. So, and then in 2 years, they're like, okay, this really happened. Even if you're innocent, okay, go ahead. You're still on parole though. So that's why I told my lawyer, I'll do 10, I'll do 20. I just don't want life. So he came back the next day. He said, if you plead out to manslaughter tomorrow, he goes, you'll get 6 to 10. So I said, okay. So we go to court. The Crown attorney is asking for 10 years. My lawyer's asking for 7 years. And what my lawyer did was he made sure we had a female judge that had kids because of the situation. Because obviously she would read that guy's criminal record. She'd read the particulars of everything. So the judge ended up giving me 6 years. So yeah. So 1 year less than my lawyer was asking for. So he's a smart man.
Looking back, do you wish you did things differently? And if so, how?
To tell you the honest truth, I don't wish I did it differently. And there's 2 reasons behind that answer. Number one, because I think I ended up where I needed to be. Things had to happen the way they did in order for me to get where I am. And I'll tell you something just after this. Okay, so there's that answer because of that. The second answer, or the second reason, his daughter showed up to court with my family. And when I was in remand, awaiting trial, I got a card in the mail. And there was no return address. I opened it. It was a graduation picture of his second oldest daughter. So to me, that was like her saying, thank you for my life back, because they were so terrified of him. And I remember standing there with there was 2 gangsters beside me, and we're looking at that picture, and I explained to them that, and all 3 of us are standing there crying in the middle of the jail. So that meant a lot. That's what it meant to me, was I gave her life back and she was thanking me. So, and they all, like I said, they all showed up at court with my family. So I think I saved those girls. I saved them, and I made them feel more safe in the world. And with people like that, with actual monsters like that, like, you don't know how many other victims he had or would have had. So I don't regret what I did in the least. And like I said, I ended up where I needed to be.
Did the other inmates, when you were in prison, did they see it in the same way that you did? I'm not placing a word on it, but did you feel a sense of pride that you protected someone? And was that sort of like, yeah, reverberated in prison as well? Is that what the kind of way people were responding to you in prison too?
They knew I was there. Or once they knew I was there, because it's always in the paper and stuff. So the guards weren't that harsh on me. The inmates were welcoming, but also, like, I grew up in foster homes and group homes, so a lot of the guys that were already in prison, I grew up with. So I had an easy time because of that. I had an easy time because what I did, the kind of person I killed. And then another thing, in Canadian prisons, they don't rape each other. You hear about prison, you hear about rape, you hear about this. So when I first got there, we're in what you call is a fish tank. They put you in this place for 3 months and they assess you. They do all these tests, really dumb tests. Like there were some questions on there like, do you wish your father was a florist? Do you like flowers? Do you wish your mother was a mechanic? Like just, it's so weird. And there's about 500 questions. Yeah. So they assess you and they figure out if you're medium security, minimum security, or maximum security. So that's why they do that. While we were in there, this guy that did, I think it was vehicular manslaughter. So he didn't live that life. He didn't live gangster life. He got drunk and killed somebody. So he knew nothing about criminals, nothing like that. And he ended up raping somebody in there, thinking that if you rape someone, you have status now. Like you're somebody. He didn't realize that we frown upon that in Canada. We kicked the living shit out of this guy. And then he had to go to protective custody. And I made a comment about this on YouTube. And somebody's like, holy shit, even the prisoners in Canada are polite. Because with the victim, we made sure he had canteen. We gave up our phone time so he can talk to his family, like the one that got raped. So we made sure he had phone times to talk to his family so that he can, like, you know, be around people he loves. We made sure his family had rides to the prison for visits just to make sure his mental was taken care of because of what happened to him.
No, that's crazy. What are some of the other things in prison that are regarded with respect and regarded with absolute, like, no, like, we don't accept this kind of stuff? Like, I know I did an episode once with another guest who actually talked about life in prison, who mentioned that any kind of violence or sexual assault towards women or children were absolutely not acceptable. And, like, other inmates would actually make that prisoner's life hell in prison if they were charged for any of those things.
Yeah.
Is that the same? In
Yeah. The worst thing you could be is a pedophile. The worst. Or no, sorry. The worst thing you'd be is a child killer. That's the worst thing. And then a pedophile. And then somebody that either robbed, assaulted, or killed the elderly. And then there's the rats. Then you can't be a rat. You can't be... Then there's people, like, it's weird in Canada. There's guys that have killed their women that aren't, like, I don't hang out with them. They're in population, though. Like, they had a domestic assault and their woman died. They're still in population, living normal. With me, I didn't associate with those kind of guys. And then there were guys that they'd be in a domestic partnership or whatever, or a marriage, and they beat their woman to death or lose it and kill them. And first, like, I never understood it, but there's some of them that were in population that were living amongst everybody else and everyone was okay with it, but I didn't associate with those guys. And then there was guys that killed their women that were frowned upon and not in population. So I never knew what the difference was, but I guess some people knew the specifics of everything. And so I don't know if they did something after they were dead that was gross or whatever, but so I never understood that.
So I actually was asking about whether you'd come across any pedophiles or any child killers in prison and what kind of effect that had on you.
Well, doing time in prison for 12 years, you see a lot of things evolve, especially out in the real world. And one of the cool things that happened was Google, because before, the guards would get somebody really bad and they would try to fit them in population without us knowing. But every time we got new people, if somebody came in and I knew him, and I knew he was a good guy, I'd vouch for him. I'd introduce him to everybody. I'd vouch for him, tell him he's a good guy. If guys came in that we didn't know, one of us would phone our girlfriend and say, hey, Google this name. And they Google it and then tell us his charges. So we're like, okay, you got to go or you can stay. Or if it was bad, we'd act like everything was okay in the middle of a card game, invite him in one of the cells to have a cigarette or something and just beat the shit if he was a bad guy. So, but yeah, with the pedophile thing, I ended up in the gym with one of them, in the gym bathroom, not realizing that he wasn't in protective custody. They tried to put him in population, and I knew exactly who he was. I knew what he's there for, and we ended up in the bathroom together in the gym, and I was just like, fuck. So when I kicked the shit out of him, I had to keep in mind, you already did this. If you kill this guy, you're going to get second degree murder. You're going to get life because I already had a manslaughter. It was to the same kind of person. So they would see that, because first degree is obviously premeditated. You planned to kill the person. You went, you carried it out. Second degree is in the middle of something. You realize the person was going to die and you kept going. So that's what would have happened to me. So I kicked the shit out of him, reminded myself, don't go that far, and got out of there. And that felt really good, though. That felt good to get that out.
I mean, I can really sense that there was a lot of like built up like anger and just rage at the sight or the thought of anyone that hurt children. Like that was just like that was just an absolute no for you. Like you just would lose all sense of like sense basically when you came across anyone that you knew. Yeah. What did you do to finally cope with that?
What I just started talking about it in therapy, like maybe 3 months ago. I started therapy with this one guy, and we finally just started talking about that last week about what happened. So I can't say I coped with it. I've been able to keep it repressed, keep everything in there, and just remind myself like don't pop off, because there's people in the community. It's a small community, and there's people here that have done that, and I just need to avoid them. And I need to tell myself, you have a family now, you have a life now. It's not worth it. If it was up to me, there'd be a couple hit and runs. But I got to remind myself that I have a family and stuff. And the thing is too, this is going to sound weird, but I am so glad that I was a strong enough person. And I was able, even though I had parents like that, I was able to pull morals out of somewhere. I'm so glad that I did not repeat the cycle. Because I know a lot of people that went through that repeated that cycle, that became that kind of person. And I'm glad that mine turned into hatred instead of desire. Does that make sense? That's one thing I'm very thankful of.
You did mention, like off the record, that there was one cycle that you sort of picked up from your parents, which was more to do with the drugs and the alcohol. Can you talk me through that?
Okay, so this, like, it wasn't planned to become I don't think anyone plans to become a drug addict. But what happened was when I was, I was on the run. Okay, I got out of prison and I was on parole, and then I was wanted for breaching parole. So I went to Vancouver to go see my sister and her kids. And then I got to be in a short Canadian film while I was there. And I thought the whole process was so cool. So when I got locked up again, I started looking into writing screenplays. And then I wrote one. Well, I wrote a few, and there was something about it that was bugging me. Like it was done, but there was something bugging me. And I rewrote it and I rewrote it and I went through everything and I just couldn't find it. So fast forward, I don't know, 5-6 months, I help a friend fix her car. And she gives me a little baggie of meth, like 2 points of meth. And I'm like, no, go ahead. I don't do drugs. And at this point, the only drug I ever did was I smoked weed once in a while. And then when I was 16, I did acid. That was about it. So I told her, I was like, here, no, you take it. I don't do drugs. And she's like, no, you can sell it. It's like 20 bucks. I was like, no, I already got in trouble for selling drugs. But, oh, yeah, because my second time I went to jail was for selling drugs. So we can get into that. But so I told her, no. And she's like, just take it. And she wouldn't let up. So I took it, went home, threw it on my fridge, forgot about it. So I ended up finding it one day. And then I told my girlfriend at the time about it. And as a joke, she went and bought me like a meth pipe, like a bubble. She's like, here. I was like, fuck off. Like, and she was bugging me though. And then I threw that on the fridge. And then one night I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with my screenplay and I can't, and it's bugging me. So I unplug everything from the computer, plug it all back in, drag in, nothing, unplug it, thinking that'll reset my brain. And then I had enough of that. So I try to get a hold of my friends, see if they want to come drink. Nobody, you know, come smoke weed. Nobody. You got anybody need a ride? Like, I'm so bored. I got to get my head out of this. Nobody. So I was so bored, I went on YouTube and I looked up how to smoke meth. And then I smoked the meth that was there. And then all of a sudden, everything about my screenplay that was wrong just shot to the front of my head. And I was like, holy shit, plug in the computer, fixed everything. My other screenplay, put it in. Oh, this is wrong. Fixed all that. Like, just craziness. So it's true what they say, meth, don't even try it once. Because I was hooked. And then I was hooked for 2 years and we lost everything. Like, she was a welder for 9 years. She lost everything. And this is my ex. This is my fiance. My fiance is normal. But yeah, we lost everything. We lost our vehicle, everything. And then finally we broke up. And then I discovered fentanyl, and holy shit. So I ended up straight, like, actually homeless on fentanyl for 5 years, I think. And just, like I overdosed once and I died for 3 minutes, they said. And
wow.
I still went back to it. Like, after I came out of the hospital, I still went back to it. I had friends die right beside me. I still smoked it. Like, I seen the worst shit happen on that stuff, and I still went back to it. Like, my family, when I came back, when my ex-wife told me to come home, I relapsed 3 times, knowing that I could possibly lose my family. Like, my ex-wife would tell me not to come home anymore, knowing that, and I still did it. Like, the power of addiction. And that's the thing, too. I remember coming home once. Well, I was driving with my wife, or my fiance, and we're sitting outside, and we were talking about my mom for some reason. And I was clean by now. So I was like, if I got clean, why couldn't she? Why weren't we important enough to her to quit drugs? Why didn't she love us enough to quit drugs? Like, and I was freaking out, and I got all emotional and shit. And then I remember thinking about it later, and I was like, okay, I risked my family to go back to drugs 3 times. I died and still did it. Friends died in front of me, and I still did it. And I finally thought about the power of addiction. And then I thought, back then in 1987, they didn't have social media. So you couldn't reach out to friends when you felt weak. They didn't have RAM clinics, which stands for Rapid Access to Addiction Medicine, which is what helped me get clean. They didn't have that back then. They didn't have Addictions Foundation in Manitoba back then. They didn't have any resources for people that were addicted to something. So my mom had no help. She was on her own. And she committed suicide by taking a lethal dose of heroin on purpose.
Was that sort of like the first time for you that you felt a sense of like deep empathy for your mom and a deep sort of like understanding? Like, did you forgive her in a sense in that very moment?
I did. That night, after freaking out, after yelling basically at my dashboard while my fiance listened, I found that night when I thought about it, I actually forgave her for that. And like, if it wasn't for the RAM clinic, if it wasn't for social media, if it wasn't for me reaching out to people that when I needed help, when I was at my lowest, I wouldn't be here. So, like, I'll tell you the reason. Okay, this is one of the big stories I tell when I talk about holding on to hope and not letting go. So 6.5 years ago, I saved a guy passed out in a snowbank, and I got frostbite on my legs. My legs, they're still not healed. I go every 2 days for bandage changes. But they're so painful. And I was an addict, so I wasn't going to the hospital when I had to. In winter, my legs would freeze because the wounds would drip. So my legs were wet constantly. And then in the winter, it would freeze. And my legs would freeze even more, and it was already frostbite. So I got so sick of the pain. I got so sick of being able to barely walk or barely being able to walk. And I got sick of waking up every day wondering where my next fix was coming from. I got so sick of that life. And I hadn't talked to my foster parents in 2.5 years. And the last time I talked to my ex-wife, I asked her if I can come home. And she said a lot of things had changed. Her mom lived with her, best friend lived with her, and she had a foster kid. So I said, okay, I understand. It made it sound like it was no big deal. It crushed me. and we hadn't talked for 2 years. And then, like I said, my foster parents, the ones I mentioned earlier, Scott and Rebecca, we didn't talk in 2.5 years. So this was during COVID. I had one more welfare check coming up, or a social assistance check from the government. Do you know what a PICC line is, like medically? So a PICC line is when they can't find your veins, they go right here. Yeah. And they put in the tube that goes 5 centimeters above your heart. So all your meds get right to you. So I had one of those in. And before they do your meds, they use a flusher and they flush it out first, then give you your meds and flush it again. So if you're an addict, all you need to do is get your hands on one of those flushers and you can put drugs in there and then you get a shot 5 centimeters above your heart. So my plan was, with that last government check, I was going to buy fentanyl and spend it all on fentanyl, put the whole thing in the flusher and then say goodbye. Because I was sick of everything. And I'm thinking in my head, my mom killed herself with heroin. Everyone expects me to die the same way, is what I'm telling myself. And if you're serious about doing it, you're not going to be on social media saying, oh, I'm so sad, feel sorry for me, somebody reach out. Like, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it. You don't say shit to anybody. And that's what was going on. I didn't say nothing on Facebook. I kept up the positive persona I do on Facebook. So because of my legs and I had no more drugs, I knew if I went to the hospital, they would admit me because of my legs. And then I knew that the addictions team would come see me and give me anti-withdrawal medicine it would last me until I got that last paycheck. I can kill myself. So because it was COVID, they had free cable, free Wi-Fi, and free telephone. And I had a touchscreen TV that had Facebook on it. So I logged in, and this is 3 days before my plan. So 3 days before my government check, I get a message from my ex-wife. And she says, hey, I'm kind of worried about you. I had a bad dream about you last night. If you can get back to me, let me know you're okay. How are your legs doing? Blah, blah, blah. I still love you. So I was like, holy shit. It's crazy. So we talked for a bit. And then although she lives 15 minutes away from my foster parents, they hadn't spoken. And the next day, I had a message from my former foster dad, Scott, the one that I say I cherish. So he's like, hey, kiddo, I haven't talked to you in so long, blah, blah, blah. How are you doing? How are the legs holding up? You know, I hope you're good. Let me know. Love you, kiddo. So this was the day before my check. So I thought to myself, there's no way this is a coincidence. There's no way these two reached out to me before this day without talking to each other. So I decided to give it one more try. And that's why I'm here. Yeah, so I quarantined. He told me to come home again. So I quarantined, came home. Like I said, I relapsed three different times since I've been home. And then the third time, she made me promise that I would get help. Sorry. So that's when I got into counseling, and everything's been good. I've been clean ever since. So, yeah, life's good. Life's good now.
And, you know, I think that your story is like a true sort of testament of like that human spirit that, you know, there's always going to be someone there that's going to have your back, that's going to, you know, have be there in your corner, in your little corner that will just like, you know, that has love for you and hope for you and faith for you. And I really, really do wish to our listeners that may feel absolutely alone today, that feel isolated, that feel like they have no one, nowhere to go, they can listen to this and sort of know that there is always going to be someone there for them.
Yeah. Part of holding on to hope. And that's the thing. I'm so happy. Like, I never burn bridges like a lot of people do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like the moment that you started sharing your story on forums, on Reddit, that's where I found you. That's where someone else found you. It's like, you know, people are giving you a space to sort of like share your story too. And others are listening to your story. And, you know, in a sense, there's a sense of meaning in that. I can say that for me, you know, being a podcast host, sharing these kind of stories, it gives me such a deep sense of purpose too. And, you know, and gives you like a sense of like, I have meaning behind all of this, right? There is, again, hope.
Yeah. I go for bed and changes every second day, and I have to drive to the next town to the hospital, and it's about a 25-minute ride. So one day on the way there, I'll listen to Jexplex. The other day, I'll listen to you on the there and back. And that one lady, the one that actually moved to Ottawa, that older lady.
Yeah.
That's just been through like everything. That one, I was like, holy shit. Like, and I'm thinking, like, she went through all this and she's still sitting there smiling, cracking jokes. And I was like, that's amazing. That's awesome. Yeah. So, yeah. But now that I got my life back together too, my kids are back in my life. I have a 25-year-old daughter. Well, two 25-year-old daughters. One of them I don't talk to because I told her mom, because she thinks another guy is her dad because her mom got married when I went to prison. So I said, I'll respect that. But please, when she's 18, let her know. Let her know the truth. So she hasn't reached out yet. But my daughter Sky is back in my life. My son, I have a son named Baby Dale, we call him, because that was my nickname until I had him. So he's Dale the third. So he's number three. I'm junior. So he's back in my life. And then, like I said, I got my 8-year-old, and like, life couldn't be better. And if I gave up that day in the hospital, I never would have had none of this if it wasn't for those two reaching out.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, you had so many different close calls, like, throughout your whole journey in your life.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've made it through all of it.
Well, the thing too is like that wasn't my first suicide attempt too. So I look at all that stuff and I'm just glad. Like I said, like, everything that happened to me needed to happen for me to be where I am. So even like my ex-wife and I, we got divorced. We were married for 6 years. We got divorced because we got married while I was in prison, actually.
So what caused it to?
When I got out, I kept selling drugs, and she didn't like that. So she told me to fuck off. I broke my promise to her. So we ended up getting divorced. And like I said, like, that had to happen. The divorce had to happen. Everything had to happen for us to be where we are now. So, and we're closer than ever. Like, we talk more. Like, if things are getting, like, if I'm getting kind of crusty, she'll be like, what's going on? Let's talk. So I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
And she can always tell when something's bugging me.
It's like she knows how to Yeah. She can foresee it. She can stop it right in its tracks.
Yeah. She's awesome.
Do you feel like you're able to say like all of this stuff in hindsight now, or do you still feel like it's a very close, like the story is still very close to you? It's a very recent past sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, with the addiction, I'm always going to be an addict, whether I'm clean or not. Because even when you're fighting to be clean, you're still considered an addict. And I told her, like, every single day crosses my mind. Every single day suicide crosses my mind, which is harsh. But the thing is, you need to build a life worth staying away from drugs for. So even though I have these thoughts every day, I look at my son, Lawson. I look at my fiance. I look at what's more important and I focus on it. And some days, if they're not around, I got to reach down and tell myself, hey, it's not worth throwing this away, man. Like, don't. You have all this. You built all this. Like, that's even like spitting in my fiance's face because she helped me build what I have now. So that'd be very disrespectful to throw it all away.
What are some things that people can do to sort of like build, rebuild, and find that hope inside within them?
Well, first off, you got to decide, how do I word this? There's going to be people out there that say there's addicts listening to this. There's going to be some that are ready to quit, that have been looking for a way to quit, a reason to quit. And there's going to be some that aren't done yet. And that's a harsh reality that a lot of people, you can offer them all the help in the world. And they're like, well, I'm not ready to stop yet. Like, I want to party still. And then there's some that get sick of it or have seen some things that make them want to quit. So now they're reaching out for help. Now they want help. So my suggestion is, if you are done and you know you're done, get something to focus on. Get like a pillar to build around. So find out what you're most passionate about, whether it be family, whether it be, I wouldn't say a career, because it's hard to have a career if you're an active addict. But just find a pillar to build, like every good thing, wrap around that pillar. And look at that. And look at what you built. Whether you have two things on there, whether you have one, you still started. You still have that start. And for people that relapse, I always tell them, you know what? You put the drugs down once. You can do it again. You prove to yourself you could do it. So what I say, maybe even use a totem pole, for example. Build a totem pole. Focus on that. Everything you do that's good, stack on there. Focus on it. Ask yourself, do I really want to throw this away? I've come this far. Whether you're sober for 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, a year, you know, you've come this far. Do you want to throw it away? So, like, I used to hate when people were like, on social media, where they're like, oh, I've been 5 months clean, 6 months clean, and they're all whatever. And then once I got clean, I was like, holy shit, I hit a year. Like, oh my God, it's been a year. And I was so proud. And I felt so bad for feeling shitty about people that are like, oh, like, even 5 days clean is amazing. If you're on opiates or if you're on whatever drug, like, 5 days is amazing. So for me to sit there and be like, ah, shut up, no one cares. And now that I've been through it, I'm like, wow.
No, I think that's such a like a great way to put it. And I think like we should always be celebrating those that have like, you know, achieved some kind of breakthrough, right? Even if it's like two days, 3 days. And if they want to celebrate it, that's that thing that they're holding on to. Yeah. That pillar that's keeping them going. Because every time they make that post, they get comments, other people, you know, cheering them on. That's their hope that they're holding on to.
Yeah.
So exactly. Why not, right?
Yeah.
Dale, thank you so much for being on this podcast today and sharing your story with everyone and all our listeners.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed the episode and would like to help support the show, please follow and subscribe. You can rate and review your feedback on any of our platforms listed in the description. I'd like to recognize our guests who are vulnerable and open to share their life experiences with us. Thank you for showing us we're human. Also, a thank you to our team who worked so hard behind the scenes to make it happen.
Chris Trzynski,
Stefan Menzel.
The show would be nothing without you. I'm Jenica, host and writer of the show, and you're listening to Multispective.